In the movie Pulp Fiction, the character Marcellus, not known for his pacifism, decides to get medieval with a shotgun. And we have images in our minds of what medievalism was, and I suppose brutality is on that list. Is the world now getting medieval again? This is the thesis of Dr. Timothy Heath from the RAND Corporation, a well-known American non-profit global policy think tank. Timothy Heath is a senior international defense researcher at RAND. Previously, he was a US government, Asia and China analyst. He's fluent in Mandarin. Tim's published two books and many research papers, and he's written numerous articles in prominent magazines, and one recent book of his had to do with whether Taiwan can resist a military attack by China. Tim, good morning. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Nations like the US have more firepower than ever before, but they also appear weaker than ever. The upshot is a world that feels out of control. That's a headline in Vox. And that's the paradox you present us with as we find ourselves, in your view, in a neo-medieval era. I suppose many of us have a view that the centre we've been used to isn't holding. What's the primary evidence, Tim, that you see for that sort of contention as you look around the globe?
Well, I argue in my report that the world is experiencing a regression in many features of modern life, back to a norm that's closer to the average experience of humankind. And I define that neo-medieval world in five ways. First, there is a weakening of states. Second, societies are fragmenting. Third, economies are growing slowly. Fourth, threats are pervasive. And last, warfare is becoming informalized, which is to say it's experiencing a shift back to features of warfare that are more commonly seen in the developing world and pre-industrial societies, such as the reliance on private armies or contractors, a blend of uniformed and non-uniformed forces, and reliance on sieges and assassination tactics. So why is the world experiencing this? Well, we have to remember that the modern industrial period is really an anomaly in humankind. Rarely have you ever seen societies that exhibited such cohesion and internal strength, unity, and highly productive economies with a large middle class. It's really hard to find outside of the modern industrial period, and even in the last 200 years, these kind of societies really were concentrated in Europe, the United States, and New Zealand, Australia, Japan. Outside that, the level of modernization varied to different degrees. And frankly, these societies are experiencing a deindustrialization process, and exhibiting these features of state weakening and social fragmentation.
It's quite sudden, though. As far as conflict goes, if you don't mind a long question, the BBC's world affairs editor was looking at the peaceful state of the world about 10 years ago, and he made the point that deaths from war were dropping dramatically in the world to 28,000 a year, and he thought, it could be even lower in 2014. So he didn't foresee the Syrian conflict. But he's not alone. From what we know about war, we can only conclude that it's a much lesser problem today, said Monty Marshall of George Mason University, a place you know well. The New York Times writer John Tierney wrote, "So many people are living in peace, you don't have to be a dreamer like John Lennon to take seriously the question, the end of war." And Julian Simon, the economist, had told John that there's less and less to be gained economically from war. As people get richer and smarter, their lives and their knowledge become far more valuable than the land, minerals and natural resources they used to fight over. So I'm sorry about the length of the question, but I was trying to make the point. Why have these predictions turned out to be so catastrophically wrong?
Well, I think one major reason is they're looking at the wrong thing. So a lot of these theorists and analysts were focusing on the incidence of warfare between states. And what they tended to overlook was warfare within states or intrastate conflict. Now, it is true that the incidence of warfare between states remains relatively low, but what that masks is a troubling rise in deaths and conflict that occur primarily within states and spread across states. And these are conflicts that often center around issues of ethnic, religious identity, and sectarian issues, fights over resources, and fights that occur within failing and weakening states. So, and by the way, if you look at human history, states in general, because they're much weaker and their national or top authorities did not really have the ability to ensure domestic security. Internal turmoil and internal conflict were extremely common throughout history, all the way going back to the Bible. What we've seen in the past 2 decades is, as the Cold War peace started to break down, these old forms of conflict started to emerge and intensify, and we're seeing them play out in the headlines today.
We used to talk about the great game, didn't we, played between the great powers? And you are also implying, I think, Tim, that that's over now, in a sense. I mean, the great powers don't have as much power, pure and simple. I suppose there've always been incidents, but we look, for example, about what's happening in the Red Sea with the Houthi missiles. I mean, they ain't going to stop them anytime soon. So the world seems stymied as well.
Yes. So the ability of the United States to reach out and shape events in other parts of the world, well, first off, it was never as complete as some of our history books might like to imply, but certainly that capacity has diminished considerably in the past few years. Think about and just contrast how the U.S. was able to reshape societies in Japan and Germany in the 50s and 60s when the United States was at the height of its power. And compare that with its unsuccessful effort to reshape Iraq and Afghanistan, where it simply did not have the resources and the will to change those countries in the way that it could with Germany and Japan. And that's just a symptom of general weakening and lack of ability, resources, and legitimacy on the part of major countries. They just are one, much more tuned towards their own domestic issues and problems, which have intensified. And two, they just have less appetite to expend large amounts of resources dealing with foreign problems.
How much awareness is there of this, Tim? Because the Biden administration suggests we're entering a new superpower age, which implies the superpowers are simply squaring up to one another in a new way, evolution. But in this new paper you've written, you see devolution, don't you?
Again, the Cold War was a standoff between nation states in the prime of their health. And what we're facing today between the United States, China, Russia, and Iran are nation states in decline. These are much weaker states. They cannot mobilize societies in the way that the US and Soviet Union could in the 50s and 60s. I mean, just look at the US, it's deeply polarized and divided. Look at Russia fighting supposedly for its life against NATO. The Russian government is afraid to conscript its people and has to rely on convicts, foreigners, and the poor to fill up the ranks of its military. These countries have governments that are unpopular, that have a weaker sense of legitimacy, and a great deal of internal discontent. And that makes it harder for these countries to contend with each other. I think there are hard limits to how much they can afford to antagonize one another, even though paradoxically, their very weakness makes it easier and easier for other countries to meddle, provoke, and generate antagonism.
Okay, and we, from just a general knowledge of history, can see the similarities lying in there with the world we knew at the time of the French and US revolutions and prior to that. So we can understand, I think, what characterizes a neo-medieval era, as you've outlined. There's something else going on, and is this also medieval? I mean, however seriously one regards the January 6th attack on the US Capitol as insurrection or as a kind of hopeless, hapless, but violent incursion, it was certainly a microcosmic example of the schisming of American political view. And there have been violent outbreaks on the left as well as the right. But America isn't the only riven country. In fact, the more this century progresses, authoritarian crackdowns aside, is this what we'll see more and more? I mean, we had an occupation here outside our parliament with people dissenting over numerous grievances. So is this what we can expect more and more of?
I'm afraid so. The fundamental issue is that all these countries, as they are deindustrializing and experiencing slower growth, simply cannot generate the resources to meet the expectations of their people. And this includes China, by the way. The Chinese government has been very frank in admitting that they simply cannot meet the needs of their own people. The lower performance of the state intensifies discontent, and then people demand remedies that the state cannot, they can't meet those expectations, which diminishes the legitimacy more. And that invites extremists and opportunists to immobilize their own supporters and come up with their own solutions, often very extreme and unworkable. But for some people, it's some kind of hope, and they maybe feel there's nothing to lose. So given that, it's very hard to see how these states can turn things around. I think that what is critical is for governments and political leaders to think about how do we navigate this new normal?
Yeah, and if the management doesn't produce results, of course, people will simply come to cease believing in political promises and the competence of political management, yeah?
Yes, that's a real danger, that people lose confidence in authorities and turn to other sources for meaning and leadership. This is one reason why the Chinese government is so relentless in its crackdown and repression. They are aware that the diminished legitimacy of the CCP opens opportunities for people to transfer their loyalties elsewhere. And it's a phenomena that's occurring around the world. If you read the headlines, even in Russia, there are groups that are organizing, that want extremist groups, but they declare their intent to overthrow Putin or to side with Ukraine or otherwise express their intense opposition to Russia, which is in part why Putin is also very relentless in his repression. But, U.S., Western countries, while fighting ISIS, you had the strange phenomena of volunteers going over to side with ISIS against Americans and Europeans, which is kind of a shock, but it just is a hint of the deep alienation that a lot of people are feeling, a level of disaffection, and a sense that their loyalty is up for grabs.
Timothy Heath is talking to us, author and also senior international defense researcher at RAND. So we're seeing statehood challenged from within, exacerbated, as you say, by mistrust in our institutions, but also by disgust, I think, at greed. We're seeing corporations dominating much of the everyday life of the planet. And you mentioned China. We're also seeing increasing tyranny, presumably, as the powers that be seek to control this unruliness more.
Yes. So you hinted at one of the issues is this problem of yawning inequality and lack of social mobility. It's occurring in both liberal democracies and authoritarian states. In our country, we're still grappling with this. That it's generating political violence in some cases. Even in countries like Japan, we had the recent report, the shocking assassination of former Premier Abe, But European countries are experiencing the rise of more extreme political parties, and reports of political violence in the US. The levels have reached a point that hasn't been seen since the Civil War.
And here in New Zealand, we're trying to ban gang patches, the patches that gang members wear, and that's admittedly a far more minor example of what you're describing, but it does seem to illustrate the trend, even in peaceful enough societies, towards cracking down on trouble. That's the.
Well, you hint at something actually that's related, and I discussed in my report, is as avenues for legitimate advancement diminish, illicit avenues of moving up become more and more attractive. And it's not a coincidence that the world is facing a pretty serious and an intractable problem of organized crime and criminal activity. I can't help but notice a lot of our consumer culture, media culture, TV culture celebrates criminality with TV shows like Breaking Bad and all these heist movies and TV shows. Squid Games is a or other shows that glorify this idea that anything that gets you ahead is justified. It's just another expression of this despair felt by many over the possibility of moving up and enjoying a good life through legitimate means, and a growing attractiveness of illicit and in some cases outright criminal means. Again, it's an issue not just in the West. China has a serious problem with mafias and crime. It's the information is suppressed by the authorities, but it's pretty severe there.
Foucault said the more you apply centralized power, the more it meets with decentralized resistance. I think that's what he said, more or less. And okay, so that's also present in Chinese life, but it seems contained or seems to be from the outside. But in other times and places like Ceausescu's Romania, those pockets of resistance suddenly coalesce and become a large hole that dictators fall into. So these situations don't go on forever either.
Yeah, I mean, you think of the medieval period, upheaval and civil strife were pretty common. There were many peasant rebellions. Often they were suppressed, but sometimes they would catch fire. But there was constant tension between the authorities. Even the king had to deal with powerful nobles that defied him and challenged his authority. And we are facing this issue today where national leaders are contending with subnational leaders who resist their authority. Certainly in the US, this is an issue. China, it's an issue. I don't want to predict what will happen to all these states. I'm partial to the view that they will evolve into a kind of a state form where the authorities promise much less but can deliver on their promise. And it could just be, they could promise more fair opportunities, even though there are actually fewer opportunities for available to people. But either way, it seems like these societies are definitely going to be, I think, harder to govern than was the case in the 50s and 60s, when you just had this incredible prosperity that in 30s and 40s, even in many cases outside the world wars. This incredible success of these nation states brought a lot of domestic security that was a luxury we may not be able to enjoy anymore.
Which is such a sad reflection. Everyone who knows the Yeats poem, The Second Coming, knows about the falcon not hearing the falconer and the rough beast slouching on its way to upend society. I'm not sure that prophecy came true exactly, but I wonder if it does cyclically, Tim. I mean, war, chaos, a desire for order again, prosperity, boredom, impatience, chaos, war. Does that apply through history?
You really have to look to the developing world to see what is more common in human experience, and you'll see actually quite a bit of continuity with countries in the developing world and pre-industrial societies, the regimes tend to be less secure. Subnational actors are more autonomous. There is often high inequality, more volatility in politics, but in some cases that can be stable. And maybe that's what we are going to have to figure out is how do we build stability in conditions where the old prescriptions just aren't going to work anymore.
Well, in the old days, you had religion. I mean, can you see secular states disappearing, or as you see it, schisming, no longer held together by the glue of religious purpose?
Or, the religion was one part of a national culture, but the idea of patriotism, this idea where the nation as a kind of people, a national, ethnic culture was fused with loyalty to the state, this idea of patriotism, that seems to definitely have diminished, and it's hard to see it coming back. I wish I had a crystal ball and could foresee how this will all evolve. I don't know, but I do think the old prescriptions of trying to rebuild that sort of patriotism from the 60s and 70s, very difficult to do when the economic base to underpin it just isn't there.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, even in Ukraine, with its fairly enlightened, under the circumstances, conscription, men obviously avoid the draft. And as you say, same in Russia. And Putin, I think, is careful to take most of his soldiers from the countryside, not the more sophisticated cities. And we had the Wagner Group, didn't we, which also had echoes of medieval allegiance, as you're referring to.
No, they could have overthrown Putin. This actually happened quite a bit in the medieval age when mercenary groups were dissatisfied with how they're being treated. They would just sometimes attack their employers.
And in support of your argument, a recent poll found that nearly a third of Britons aged 18 to 40 said they would refuse to serve in the military, nearly a third of them, if a world war broke out and the country was in under imminent threat of invasion. The Middle East seems pretty neo-medieval and has for some time. Is that a model, admittedly not a cheerful one, that we can look at?
Well, I think the developing world in general holds a lot more clues to our future than we want to admit. We have to see how other countries are grappling with issues of low legitimacy, weakening state authority, social fragmentation, imbalanced economies, and Middle East is one model, not a cheerful one. Remember, that's not the only possibility. There is, again, if just looking at the developing world, you got countries in Southeast Asia, which are much more stable. I think we have lessons to learn from studying how all these countries in the developing world are dealing with these issues.
If China sought to invade Taiwan and its efforts were thwarted for long enough, would resistance rise within China or not?
I'm of the view that it would. We know right now, I mean, you mentioned the poll about the Brits, but people don't realize, I think, that in China, resistance to serving in the military is a big problem as well. In fact, just a year or two ago, the government issued a national defense mobilization law that laid out for the first time severe penalties for draft dodging, because this has become such a severe problem. So I think even I mean, think about it, in peacetime with unemployment so high, young people in China simply do not want to serve in the military. At least the educated people do not. There's plenty of peasants who would love to serve, but they're not wanted in the modern PLA. So there's already resistance to military service. War is not popular in China, although there's a lot of commentary predicting the Chinese are bellowing for war. There's all evidence that we have, polls and surveys conducted by Western scholars suggests the Chinese people would love to see Taiwan unified, but not through war. So if the CCP decide to invade Taiwan, I think it would be extremely high risk politically. And frankly, I think the biggest constraint on the Chinese trying to attack Taiwan is political. Is there severe political weakness of the state and lack of support by the people if this decided to go down that path?
Well, another question about China, because your level of knowledge here is high. Is China, from what you're saying, reminiscent of the so-called map of empire, you know, where the empire looks very strong and serene enough on the map, but if you peer under the map, it's not like that at all?
I do think that the Chinese state is more fragile than it appears. The centralization and repression that's occurred under Xi is simply symptomatic of the weaknesses that have compounded over the time as the economy has decelerated and as problems of corruption have proven intractable and opportunities for common people diminished. I think that, and I have to say, I've been reading a lot of Xi Jinping speeches, and overwhelmingly, the biggest problems he identifies are not Taiwan and the US, but domestic problems and the kinds that we just talked about: unemployment, corruption, popular disaffection, crime. All these are the issues that keep Xi Jinping awake at night, and they're extremely severe in China. As bad as our problems are in the US, I think Xi Jinping would love to trade with Biden in a heartbeat.
Gee, that's a statement. So just to wrap things up, you were describing postulating, you know, big powerful states with small sized options in the future, and maybe more states, you know, with agendas of their own finding their way. I suppose a nuclear war would change that though, Tim.
I can't even imagine. Annihilation of societies would certainly change things. I really haven't really conceptualized like what
Well, how
the
can you?
aftermath of
How can you?
how can I mean it's just such an extreme situation. Hopefully we never have to really face that.
I suppose I was reminded of it because, you know, if there's enough devolution, then of course nuclear missiles might find their way into the hands of people who are simply rash enough to use them. That's why I mentioned that.
No, I think that's fair. There is, I think, as states weaken and subnational actors become more powerful, there is a huge risk of proliferation. And in that environment, loose nukes getting out there is a worrying possibility.
You're not necessarily painting a picture of complete gloom. Nuclear war aside, people might live happily enough in the circumstances you're describing, unless, of course, they were suddenly found themselves in a localized place of violence. If humans have lived that way for a long time, then, or used to, then all is not lost.
Yeah, I mean, there some upsides are that I think the pattern in which interstate war remains uncommon will hold. War is so expensive now with these high-tech machines and weapons, and so costly in terms of what it does to political legitimacy that very few states are willing to take that risk. And I think China is in that group. Even the US arguably is increasingly re reluctant to get involved directly in a war. Europe certainly has been that way for a while. Even Russia, it seems eager to try to close out this conflict with Ukraine, but obviously Putin has vested so much in it that he can't afford to appear to have lost. I think a lower risk of interstate war is one of the upsides. For stability, greater stability to occur, doesn't have to be constant internal strife and internal conflict. If these states can be governed better and authorities find a way to at least address some of the needs that the people are demanding, it could stabilize and have a different kind of peace than perhaps we've seen in the past.
Or we could see the disappearance of democracy. I mean, sectors of society just refusing to accept the decisions of the majority and setting off on their own to do what they want to do or try to.
Yeah, well, the health of liberal democracies is, it is a it's a worrying concern. All the data that is out there by political scientists suggests the younger generations are becoming less and less enthusiastic about democracy and more skeptical about the benefits. And in general, liberal democracies were most healthy when there's large middle classes to buttress and support them. If the middle class diminishes, then the most important constituency just isn't there, and then there is a high risk that demagogues or other opportunists can take advantage of people's discontent.
Yeah, well, it's heaven help us. I mean, didn't Churchill say something about democracy is a terrible form of government until you compare it with all the other ones?
Yeah, he did say that.
Very interesting to have your point of view, though, and very good of you to give us the time to share it with us, Tim.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for the chat.
Great conversation. I really, really enjoyed this. So, yeah, thanks for having me.